From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Whether or not you've read any of Arthur Conan Doyle's stories, you know Sherlock Holmes. The scholar Leslie Klinger points out there are hundreds of actors who've played the part on stage, on radio, on screen, of course, and there have been dozens of scholarly books and magazines, not to mention fan clubs and book clubs. Klinger says Sherlock Holmes is one of the three best-known personalities in all the world. And why? What is it that makes the character work? Well, part of it are the stories themselves, of course, the intricate tales that grip as they unfold. But one Holmes scholar says he's popular because he's the personification of something in us that we either lost or never really had. It's competence and self-assurance and wisdom. Today in the program, we're talking about one of literature's great characters, Sherlock Holmes, after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The scholar Leslie Klinger tells the story when he was on book tour years ago. A woman approached him, said that she had been a big fan of Sherlock Holmes for years. She had just never known that there were any books. Whether or not you've read any of the Arthur Conan Doyle stories, you know Sherlock Holmes. There have been dozens of scholarly books and magazines published every year about him, not to mention the fan clubs, the book clubs, the hundreds of actors who played the role. When a new Sherlock Holmes blockbuster came out last year, it did $40 million on its opening weekend, which is not bad for a hero who's been around for some 125 years. Klinger says Holmes has pretty much always been popular ever since Arthur Conan Doyle first introduced him in 1887. Today in the program, we're talking about why. We're exploring Sherlock Holmes as a character and as a figure. Leslie Klinger joined us. He is a literary scholar who specializes in two icons of the Victorian era, Sherlock Holmes and Dracula. He was a technical advisor for the movie starring Robert Downey Jr., and he joined us in December. Leslie Klinger, like a lot of us, was introduced to the character when he was younger, but he didn't really become fascinated with Sherlock Holmes until a little bit later in his life.
I was in law school, and I want to say that I was a good student in law school, but I also had rigid rules about how much studying I was willing to do. My rule was that at 11 o'clock at night, I required myself to do recreational reading. And I received a gift of a book that changed my life. It had come out in 1967. This was 1968 that I was a second-year law student. The book was called The Annotated Sherlock Holmes by William S. Baring-Gould. And for the first time in my life, I paid attention to the Sherlock Holmes stories. But it was more than that. It wasn't the stories that really grabbed me. It was the footnotes. Now, this is a twisted part of my personality,
yes,
I must admit. But it was the discovery that there were these people, Sherlockians, or Holmesians, as they're called in England, who were fascinated by Holmes and Watson and the stories and the times, and were willing to devote tremendous amounts of energy to researching and writing about the stories. And I wanted to be like that. I wanted to be as smart as those people were. And so I plunged in.
So being a Sherlockian, which we should explain, is this idea, or a game, I think, as you described it, where you treat the Sherlock stories not as fiction, but as real, I guess, as biography.
No, as biography.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, biography written by, mostly written by Dr. Watson.
Sure.
How do we know that? Well, he says so.
Right.
Arthur Conan Doyle, I mean, first of all, it's hard to do this on the radio because people don't see the tongue in the cheek. But it's a game. It's a game that is very productive because it gives us an excuse to devote enormous amounts of energy to worrying about the details of stories that, if they were works of fiction, it would be trivial. It would be things like, well, Conan Doyle made a mistake. That's why Dr. Watson's wound is in his leg in some of the stories and in his shoulder in others. Well, that's not an acceptable answer if it's true.
What is the so what is a meeting like for you guys? What's the conversation like?
Well, I can't show you the secret handshake.
Okay.
But the annual event, the Baker Street Irregulars, is a much more staid organization, I think, than one might guess. This isn't a Trekkie convention. People don't dress up in costumes and all that. It's the two primary events of the Irregulars, two primary activities of the Irregulars, I should say, are publications. This year, the Irregulars is putting out, I think, 5 books on Sherlock Holmes, one of which I've edited, called The Grand Game, which collects classic Sherlockian scholarship written in the last 50 years. And the other activity is an annual dinner. It's a black tie dinner, traditionally held in Manhattan. The dinner is a mixture of sodality, a wonderful word that Christopher Morley, the founder of the Irregulars, was very fond of. That is, it's drinking and socializing. There is a certain amount of ritual toasting. There are annual toasts delivered to Mrs. Hudson, the second Mrs. Watson, and so on. And those are generally a minute or two long. They're witty.
Yeah.
They're clever. There's in-jokes only Sherlockians would get. There's usually 2 or 3 10-minute papers delivered on mostly serious subjects, with wit.
Yeah.
There's a lot of socializing. And last year, for example, we were lucky. I was able to film a 20-minute interview with Robert Downey. We showed that at the dinner.
Mm.
So those are the kinds of activities. It's a very interesting evening. It's kind of like the Ed Sullivan Show. There's something for everyone.
Yeah.
But it is not a dress up. Now, what's happened is that the dinner has become the centerpiece of an entire weekend of activities. So there's a lecture on Thursday night. This year we have a wonderful speaker, Dr. Lisa Sanders, who is a professor of medicine at Penn.
Mm.
She writes the medicine column for the New York Times Magazine, and she is the technical advisor on House, and she's a great fan of Conan Doyle.
Wait. So you said Conan Doyle. So I guess the question is, among Sherlockians, the conversations, where does Arthur Conan Doyle fit into all of this? If this is biography, what's the conversation like? I mean, how do you regard Conan Doyle?
Well, we're adaptable.
Yeah.
I mean, it used to be in the past that Conan Doyle was not mentioned. He was regarded, he was termed the literary agent. We know that Conan Doyle helped Dr. Watson to get these stories published. I actually found it was amazing the luck that I had, that someone gave me, I can't reveal who it was, a collection of letters between Arthur Conan Doyle and John Watson. They had never been examined, published, or anything. I actually published them. In these letters, we see how they became friends and how Dr. Doyle became Dr. Watson's agent, really helping him get the stories published. Unfortunately, the publisher said, "Who's this Watson fellow? You are a well-known author, Dr. Doyle. We'd like to put your name on the stories." Watson thought it over and decided that he could live with that. So the stories have all come out saying that they're written by Conan Doyle, of course, written by Watson, and they share the money, and the letters reveal the sordid financial details. But so historically, Conan Doyle was the literary agent, and he was really not mentioned, not discussed, not mentioned. Things have changed, in part because of the feelings of the head of the Irregulars, Michael Whalen, which is that Conan Doyle deserves great respect, and the founder of the feast is a lovely phrase that I like to describe Doyle. And so there often are discussions of Conan Doyle. If you look now at the Baker Street Journal, which is the publication of the Irregulars, it's the leading academic journal on Sherlock Holmes literary studies in the world, you'll often find papers studying aspects of Conan Doyle's life, perhaps things that may not even relate to Sherlock Holmes.
Wow. So let's talk about Sherlock Holmes, why he works as a character. Because it's really extraordinary just how popular Sherlock Holmes has been over the last 120 years or more, of course. And And you've written about this. In fact, you refer to Edgar Smith, and I've sort of referred to this in promoting the program. He was once the leader of the Baker Street Irregulars.
Yes, he was.
And he wrote that Holmes was, as he put it, the personification of something in us that we either lost or we never really had. And you say that's a perfectly good answer that makes a lot of sense, but that's only part of it. So explain, what is it that, why are we so intrigued with Sherlock Holmes?
Well, I think part of looking at Smith's answer is looking at when he wrote it. He wrote it in the 1950s. It's a wonderful essay. And in the 1950s, the war, World War II, it was just behind us. England had come through it. England was England yet, in the words of Vincent Stern. And so Holmes was a hero. He was a great hero. And the heroic elements of Holmes were, I think, what appealed to that generation of Sherlock Holmes fans. I'm not sure that that element is quite as important to us today. Nobody reads these stories for the brilliance of the detecting anymore because they've become in some respects almost cliches. Conan Doyle invented a lot of things that are now cliches.
Right.
And so the mysteries themselves are a little bit stale. And we're saturated now with mystery stories, television and radio and film mysteries are everywhere. So I think there's other aspects to Holmes's personality that make him so appealing. For me, it's the outsider status.
Yeah.
This is a man who doesn't care about the rules of society, doesn't care necessarily about the law. He is willing to take the law into his own hands. He pursues justice, not legality. And he is driven to pursue justice, whether it involves a violation of the law or not. He is going to let someone off if they are innocent in his view, even though they may be legally guilty of something. And similarly, he's going to pursue someone who is guilty, even though there may not be a legal case against them. I think that outsider status, that independence, that willingness to do what's right, I think that strikes a real chord in us, that we'd like to believe that that's who we would be.
It's interesting. So that's appealing to us now. In the Victorian era, was that idea of him being a bohemian, as Watson describes him, no regard for a convention, seems like he's something of a hoarder, can't throw things away, you know, disheveled, although he knows right where to find it when he needs it. But
yes.
Was that an appealing characteristic, or did they see him as something different than we do today?
I think the genius of Conan Doyle was that all of those things are there, but I think they have appealed to different ages. I think in the Victorian age, Holmes's fascination for the public was that this was proof that reason and science could conquer the world, could change things, could be forces for the side of good. We have to keep in context Holmes's role outside the police. And the hard part for us to realize is that the whole idea of a police force was a relatively new idea.
Right.
There weren't any police until the early 19th century. There wasn't a detective force until mid-century. There weren't public murder trials until the late century. And so this whole idea of the police being competent was a difficult one to get across. The public didn't generally regard that. They saw everybody as Inspector Lestrade. They saw the police that way. Bumblers, bunglers, people they didn't want interfering in their lives. So Holmes was a demonstration that it could be done right, and that there were smart people out there who could use the law and bring about justice.
You know, as you say, there was a particular interest in science in the Victorian age, and you have to understand the Victorian age, you point out, to understand Sherlock Holmes as a character. And science had evolved, you write about, from, you know, this interest in natural philosophy and natural history, and now we were starting to see the profession of actual scientists emerging. And this is an important piece of context for understanding the Sherlock Holmes stories, I guess.
Yes, but I think many people see the Sherlock Holmes stories as mere nostalgia. They think that the strong appeal of those stories is that we get to revisit. It's always 1895,
yeah.
as one scholar said. I think that sells the story's truly short, and there's no clearer demonstration of that to me than the success of the BBC series Sherlock that's airing, that aired last season, three episodes last season, three more seasons will be on PBS in May. This is a Holmes move to the 21st century with a cell phone, texting, laptop, website, all of the modern devices, and it's fascinating to see that Holmes has an important role, basically the same important role, which is to look beyond the trees. Now it's looking beyond the trees of all the CSI, all the forensic stuff, and make sense of it.
It's interesting. So how malleable is that character then for you? You're fine with the fact that he's set now in modern time. What's interesting is the thing that you write, though, is that London, is it necessary for London to be his home? I mean, that's an important part of context for it, that you say it's hard to take Sherlock Holmes out of London. London was his home, and the city was growing, and there was all of this crime.
Right.
But does that matter?
Well, it matters if you're going to have the real Sherlock Holmes. You can have a pseudo Sherlock Holmes that does the same in another place. But part of what makes Holmes so powerful is his deep knowledge of London.
Yeah.
Now, as we see in the BBC series, it can be a 21st century knowledge of London.
Sure.
But it's London for Holmes. Now, can you have a Sherlock Holmes in America? Of course. But that's not Sherlock Holmes now. That's a character who's like Sherlock Holmes. And one of the things that we had great fun with in this collection, A Study in Sherlock, is seeing authors play with the idea of a Sherlock Holmes. We did not ask those contributors, and there was wonderful, amazing authors in that collection. I mean, Neil Gaiman, Lee Child, Laura Lipman, S.J. Roseanne, on and on. There's 16 stories, and each one is by an A-list author. We asked them to be inspired by Holmes, and some of them chose to write stories that don't even mention Sherlock Holmes. Mm. There's a terrific story, I think, by my friend Lionel Chetwynd, who's a brilliant screenwriter, director, who had never written a short story before, by the way. Who wrote a story about a sergeant major of the army who is a U.S. Army military policeman and his younger companion, and it's Holmes and Watson in a totally different setting without a mention of Holmes or Watson.
Leslie Klinger is with us. He's the author of the new annotated Sherlock Holmes, most recently co-edited A Study in Sherlock, Stories Inspired by the Holmes Canon. Just reference there. We have to take a brief break, but we'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation about Sherlock Holmes with the literary scholar Leslie Klinger. He's the author of the new annotated Sherlock Holmes and, most recently, A Study in Sherlock, Stories Inspired by the Holmes Canon. So tell us about Arthur Conan Doyle. Born in Edinburgh, Scotland, large family, a poor family. Education was very important. What do we have to understand about Arthur Conan Doyle that leads us to the character he created, Sherlock Holmes?
I think a fascination with storytelling and a fascination with science. This is a doctor, and that's very important because he's been trained in science, and he is inspired by a professor named Dr. Joseph Bell, He's inspired not as heavily as one might like to think, but nonetheless inspired. Bell taught his students the importance of observation, and Doyle has said quite clearly in his autobiography that when he came to mold the character of a detective, and he really loved telling stories, and he wanted to be a storyteller, he decided that he could try his hand at a detective. He thought he could do it better than those who had come before him. He knew the works of Poe, he knew the works of Gaboriau and other early mystery writers, but he thought he could do it better. He thought of his old professor, Joseph Bell, who stressed observing trivial or seemingly trivial details to reach conclusions, and he worked that into the character of Holmes.
It's interesting, a lot has been made of that connection with Joseph Bell. I think you sort of implied there what I think may be the more of the reality, that he had some influence, but it wasn't as if he had, you know, drawn the character completely from
Absolutely.
Bell.
Absolutely. There are certainly other characteristics. I mean, for example, we see that Holmes today might well be diagnosed as bipolar. Mm. Some have suggested autistic. But he has some interesting personality traits. This is a man who vacillates between torpor, absolute laziness, lying on the couch, reading newspapers, to frenzied activity, hurling himself on the ground to look for clues and so on. Where did that come from? Certainly didn't come from Bell. I think part of it came from Doyle's father, who was an alcoholic, very ill alcoholic. And again, Doyle watched his father go from manic activity, fits of sobriety, to incarceration in an asylum and so on. So there's other elements.
Yeah.
He certainly stole from Poe. There's no question about it. That he took some of the characteristics of Dupin. But the greatest invention, I think, is not Sherlock Holmes. The greatest invention that Doyle brought to the story is Dr. Watson.
Watson, yeah. Why?
Because Holmes is not somebody that you really want to be around very long. He is prickly, difficult to talk to, keeps a great deal to himself, and likes to be the dramatic actor who springs surprises and all that. It's the viewpoint of Dr. Watson that makes these stories accessible on a human level. It's Dr. Watson that we'd like to sit and talk with and have as our friend and bask in the glory of knowing that there's Holmes there, but he's our friend. He's not the guy we're talking to.
It's interesting, because I wonder if that reveals to you, anyway, this is sort of the way I was thinking about it, that conflicted relationship that Conan Doyle himself has with Sherlock Holmes. And we'll sort of get to this
yes.
attempt he makes, well, he does, to kill him off. And glad he's gone, Conan Doyle, at some point.
No question about it. I think it's probably helpful if we look briefly at sort of the literary career of Holmes.
Yeah.
So Conan Doyle has been writing stories with very modest success until in 1887 he creates a story called A Study in Scarlet. He has a very difficult time getting it published. Eventually it lands in a magazine called Beaton's Christmas Annual. He gets paid a paltry sum for it. And notwithstanding Dorothy Sayers' comment that it was a literary bombshell, some other person more accurately said, well, it was a dud of a literary bombshell. It didn't really gather much attention. But Doyle was a well enough known writer that a year later or so, he was invited by Lippincott's magazine to a dinner by an editor of Lippincott's, J.B. Stoddard, where he sat with another young writer named Oscar Wilde, and was commissioned by Lippincott's to write a story. Conan Doyle decided that it would be another detective story, and he might as well use Holmes again. He wrote this one called The Sign of Four. It appeared first in Lippincott's and then in book form in England. It was more successful. There's no doubt about it. It was much more successful. But still, it wasn't captivating the public. It wasn't suddenly the great thing. That happened in 1891 when, over the transom of the Strand magazine, Conan Doyle's agent delivered two short stories. Greenough Smith, who was the editor of The Strand, tells that he read these stories and was electrified. Electrified. This could be one of the greatest storytellers of the modern age, he thought. They published those stories and commissioned Conan Doyle to write 10 more, and then another series of 12. So between 1891 and 1893, the stories that were eventually collected as The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes and The Memoirs of Sherlock Holmes appeared, and they were wildly successful. The Strand magazine zoomed up in subscriptions. The reading public went crazy. Remember, this is a time with no radio, no television, and reading was the thing. And this was this new idea, a series character. That was really quite an original idea.
Really?
That you would have a series of stories about a continuing character and his milieu, and you could read just that one story, and if you had to wait for the next issue to read another story, that was okay, because the one story was complete. This wasn't serialization of a novel. This was a short story with a continuing character.
Let me back up for just a second, because I wanted to ask you about the image of Sherlock Holmes. I mean, the illustrations created first by Sidney, is it Paget?
Yes.
You say that the Holmes that he creates, that he draws, is, this commanding figure who's tall, described as not overly lean, seems like he's handsome, kind of striking in some ways.
I think he's a little funny looking in the Paget illustrations.
But you say the image is not, it doesn't bear much resemblance to Conan Doyle's descriptions in the book.
Right. Conan Doyle says that he looked like a cigar store Indian, hooked nose, hawk-like eyes, and so on. This was a slight glamorization of the character. Paget actually used his brother Walter as the model, but nonetheless, they're compelling illustrations.
But did it help the character take off, that people now had an image to fix to?
Absolutely. Part of the whole strategy of the Strand magazine was to copy the idea of the American magazines of the day and to have heavily illustrated stories. George Nunes, the publisher, originally intended a picture on every page. He ended up a picture every other page. So you have stories that may go 10 pages, you'll have 5 pictures. So you really do get to see Dr. Watson, you get to see Sherlock Holmes, you get to see some of the villains and other people in the stories.
This does make me wonder, I have to say, about what your conversations were like with Robert Downey Jr. when you were talking to him about the character. He came to you, talked to you a lot about that character, and I'm wondering, in terms of creating some kind of physicality, what did you tell him that helped him create a physical character of Sherlock Holmes?
Well, two things. I mean, first of all, after we got past the Robert, you're too short, and so am I, we moved on to two things that I think really fascinated Robert, who is, by the way, very intelligent and very nice person. One was that the stories absolutely support the physicality that he wanted to bring to the character. When we read the stories, we learn that Holmes is a amateur boxer of some note. He is a single stick aficionado. Single stick is like fencing, except it's with a cane-like weapon. That he knows the martial art, which in the story is called Baritsu. That's probably, it should have been Bartitsu, which was an actual martial art invented by an Englishman. So he's not this, excuse the description, Basil Rathbone-like older man who doesn't do much in a physical way, except for one film in which he hangs from the ceiling. This is a younger man. When we look at the chronology of the stories, we can see that in A Study in Scarlet, the first of the Sherlock Holmes stories, it's 1881. Holmes is 27 years old. Wow. He's a young man in these stories. And Watson is pretty close. And Watson himself is also physical, other than his torn Achilles tendon. He's a runner. He too, is a sportsman. So that part really appealed to Robert. The other part that we talked about at some length was what makes Holmes tick. Why is he so driven to pursue justice in the ways that we've talked about? And I think what appealed to Robert most was that I couldn't really answer that question.
I was going to say, that's Conan Doyle, we don't have much of a backstory.
Right.
For
and we talked about what backstory there was, and we talked a little bit about some of the speculations that have gone on, stories like Nicholas Meyer's 7% Solution, in which he's driven by revenge for his mother's adultery and his father's murder of his mother, etc. That's a little fanciful for my taste, but he liked the idea that there were these dark shadows in Holmes's past and that Robert could invent his own motivations. He knew where he was going to go. He knew that he was going to create a character that was a little bit crazy, because that's the way Holmes is. He's over the top. He's bohemian. As I said, prickly. My favorite scene in the first film is the scene where Holmes and Watson are riding in a carriage, and Holmes says to Watson a correct line, a line from one of the stories, in which he says, "Watson, you have the grand gift of silence." And Watson looks at him and punches him in the nose. Conan Doyle didn't have the punch in the story, but it absolutely worked for me, and I thought that they really got that part right.
It's interesting, the questions about Holmes' mental state. He seems, what do you make of that? He is distracted. It seems like he has kind of an attention deficit disorder almost in some ways, yet then an intense focus. It's extraordinary.
Asperger's syndrome, perhaps? Huh. This is, by the way, I mentioned Lisa Sanders, who is going to be our distinguished speaker this year. She wrote an article for the New York Times Science column in which she argued that Holmes had Asperger's. And I don't know, I'm not a doctor, I don't know whether Holmes actually was diseased, but he certainly had these kinds of mood swings, strong personality traits, and he's a little crazy.
So we were headed toward the relationship between Sherlock and Watson and how that was reflected in Conan Doyle's relationship. Sorry, I distracted
exactly,
you.
And I distracted myself. I was explaining about the literary career. We do have 3 hours, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. So in 1893, the last of those 24 stories was a story called The Final Problem. And in that story, Holmes dies at the hands of Professor Moriarty at the Reichenbach Falls. When I say dies, he and Moriarty go over the edge of the falls together. And Watson begins the story saying, "These are the last words I shall ever write of my friend Sherlock Holmes," etc. So that's 1893. And Doyle delighted in having done that. He had planned it for a while. And he wrote a letter to his mother saying, "Killed Holmes." You know, the reason was that Conan Doyle saw himself as a real writer, not just a man who would write pulp fiction, detective stories. He wanted to write romantic stories, historical novels, science fiction, horror, some important nonfiction work, and so on. And the Holmes stories were a distraction. They were a great deal of work. He said he complained he had to come up with a new idea for every story. And he thought they were keeping him from better things. So he wanted to kill off Holmes. So that's 1893. He went off and did other things. In 1901, he had an idea for what he called a real creeper of a mystery. The story became The Hound of the Baskervilles. And somewhere in the middle of writing the story, he decided to put Holmes into it because he really decided he needed a strong detective figure. But The Hound of the Baskervilles, published in 1901, is clearly a reminiscence of Holmes.
Yeah.
It's events that take place before the Reichenbach Falls incident. It wasn't until 1903 that Doyle was induced with a lot of money from Collier's Magazine to write 10 new stories. The Strand Magazine published the first of them. It's called The Empty House. With no fooling around, the headline was "The Return of Sherlock Holmes." Holmes reveals that he didn't die at the Reichenbach Falls. He was never in the chasm. He escaped, and he goes on at that point to finish out his career. It's 1894 in London. The story is published in 1903. It's 1894 in London. Holmes is back. He pursues his detecting career for another roughly 8 or 9 years, and then retires. There's only two more stories after his retirement. one in 1907, and one in 1914. But this is a span. Now, these stories, these later stories, are published between 1903 and 1927. So we have a 40-year span of the Sherlock Holmes stories being published.
Do you think that... I wanted to ask you, Conan Doyle writes this once, you mentioned this in your book, that if he had grown weary of the Holmes character from time to time because his character admits of no light or shade. He is a calculating machine, and anything you add to that simply weakens the effect. What does he mean by that? What's his sense of that character then?
I think it's a very telling remark because it makes Holmes very different, and perhaps this is part of his popularity, very different from modern detectives. We clearly want our modern detectives to be filled with demons, and driven by their own ghosts and have personal lives and personal problems. They're chasing a sexual partner, they're in a romantic involvement, they have children, they have dogs, they have cats. Holmes has none of those. He's a much simpler, cleaner character. And in that respect, we pretty much know what we're going to get when we pick up a Sherlock Holmes story. We're not going to wonder about whether Holmes is off his game in this story, or he's not feeling up to it, or, did he have a hot date the night before and he's just not going to bring his best to the case, and whatever. We don't worry about those things with Holmes. He's pretty much the same in all the stories, except that there's clearly a chronology. Yeah. Holmes does get older. He does reminisce from time to time. But his circumstances don't change. He calls Watson the one fixed point in a changing age, but Watson gets married and then loses his wife, comes back to live with Holmes, marries again. It's Holmes who is the perennial bachelor in that apartment, never leaving it, never has any other friends besides Watson.
Leslie Klinger is with us. He's the author of The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes. Most recently, he co-edited A Study in Sherlock, Stories Inspired by the Holmes Canon. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Sherlock Holmes with the scholar Leslie Klinger, author of The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes, among a number of other books on the character. I wanted to ask you, Leslie Klinger, about the observations of the writer John Le Carré, who writes an introduction to your annotated Sherlock Holmes. And he writes that when you first look at Conan Doyle's writing in the Holmes books, that it's disappointing, that there aren't these clever adjectives, no remarkable turns of a phrase, not even really, he says, any interesting psychological insights. But then he says the writing represents a kind of narrative perfection. I wanted you to explore that with me. That's really interesting, and maybe it gets at why the books work themselves as well.
I'm not a great literary scholar, notwithstanding your kind introduction, so I'm not sure I understand everything Le Carré was trying to say there, but I think the stories work, again, perhaps for some of the reasons that we were just talking about, the simplicity, the cleanliness of the characters. Mm. We don't have deeply troubled psychological problems on view when we look at Holmes or Watson. We have characters that we like, we can depend on them. They're going to be I want to say predictable, but that sounds like the stories are pretty shallow.
Yeah.
Predictable in that we know what we can count on. We know what we're going to get from them. And while Doyle absolutely appreciated historical research, The White Company, for example, which is a novel of his about the 14th century, was meticulously researched. The Sherlock Holmes stories, interestingly, his most enduring work, was not carefully researched stuff. It was written casually, and we get so caught up in it, we get caught up in his imagination, that it doesn't matter. I mean, who can believe a snake that drinks milk from a saucer? Or a dog with coated with phosphorescent materials to make him glow? You know, these are fanciful things, but we get so caught up because the style is not pretentious. The style is lucid, limpid, all those wonderful adjectives, and it unpretentious, that we're absolutely entranced. Now, I think some see these wrongly as boys' tales.
Yeah.
And I think that really sells them short. Conan Doyle himself described them as written for the, excuse these sexual references, the man who was half a boy and the boy who was half a man. But I think he undersold his own appeal. First of all, it's clearly written as well for the woman who's half a girl and the girl who's half a woman, because there are plenty of female Sherlock Holmes fans. Many of the Baker Street Irregulars, probably a quarter of the Irregulars now, are women.
Well, despite Sherlock Holmes' seemingly ambivalence toward women.
Yes, but I think he exaggerates. He has he shows nothing but graciousness and kindness to women, and he is certainly impressed with several of the women who he meets in the stories. And we have to give him a little bit of a pass on that, because this is the Victorian times.
Yeah.
It was not a great time to be a woman. It was a time when women were struggling to emerge from the role of mother and daughter, work only in the home, have no responsibilities, earn no living. Women are changing their role, and the stories are slow to reflect that. It's very interesting that Conan Doyle was opposed to the suffragette movement and yet was the president of the National Divorce Reform Union, felt strongly that women should be free to have marriages or relationships that worked for them and not trapped by the antiquated laws.
Hmm. What do you think is his best work? I think The Hound of the Baskervilles, is that his masterpiece, you think?
Well, my favorite of all the stories is The Blue Carbuncle. Christopher Morley called it a Christmas story without slush. It's set the day after Christmas, and what to me, it's the combination of a very clever mystery, brilliant deductions by Holmes, and a truly warm demonstration of the friendship between Holmes and Watson.
Hmm.
The story opens with Watson coming to see Holmes the morning after Christmas. Holmes is by himself. He has no family. Watson is really, in a sense, his family. And they get caught up in a marvelous adventure. That's my fave.
Yeah. Let's take a call from Gonzalo, who raises a question I wanted to bring up, and it's a good one. Gonzalo, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Your guest describes Sherlock Holmes as someone you can count on. However, I'm fascinated by the fact that this brilliant character has a deep flaw, which is a narcotic dependency. I was wondering if your guest could talk a little bit about that aspect of Holmes.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm going to take my answer off here.
Great. Thanks, Gonzalo. Thanks. Yeah, and put that in the context of the Victorian age, too. What were people making
sure
of the fact that he used narcotics to kind of clarify his mind?
Yes. Well, first of all, we have to put it into context. The Victorian age, we have plentiful drugs, and they are not illegal. Opium is prevalent. Cocaine and things like that are available at your local chemist shop. The dangers were not well known, were not highly publicized. So that's the contextual part of it.
Yeah.
Holmes does not use drugs to his detriment. At least he doesn't think he does. He only takes his 7% solution of cocaine. in between cases, because he rebels at stagnation. He requires mental stimulus, and this is his choice of stimulus when he is not working. He never takes drugs in the middle of a case. He would never let it interfere with his work. Now, Dr. Watson sees the dangers, and this is very foresighted of Conan Doyle, by the way. Dr. Watson sees the dangers and works, and that is part of the 40-year story arc, is watching Watson wean Holmes from the drug. He says he knows that the demon is only sleeping, however, that the drug habit could come back if Holmes is sufficiently bored.
Gonzalo, thank you very much. Here's an email from Steve, who writes, as a would-be author, can you give me your opinion about the one singular quality a character must have to grab and keep a reader's attention? How did Conan Doyle display that quality in Sherlock Holmes, Steve writes.
Wow. I think notwithstanding Sherlock Holmes, it's almost notwithstanding that. You need to write human beings. People who imitate Holmes, and there are many who have tried to copy Sherlock Holmes and write similar mystery stories, lose the humanity. They lose the feet of clay. They lose the warmth of the Dr. Watsons, and they focus only on the superhero aspects of Holmes, that he's a genius, that you know, he's super observant, and so on. I don't think that works. And when you look at some of the rivals of Holmes that appeared in the press in that time, they failed for that reason. They failed because they didn't really see the full picture of what made those stories successful, which was the combination of those things.
Let me ask you about one of the aspects of Arthur Conan Doyle's life, and Sherlock's too, is this role of spiritualism. Where did this interest come from for Conan Doyle?
Well, spiritualism arose in the sort of late middle of the 19th century, and Conan Doyle was a quester. He really strove to find spiritual answers. He was a lapsed Catholic. He'd been educated by the Jesuits, and he was very early in his life looking for something else. Spiritualism rose during that period, and he became fascinated by it, to the point where in toward the end of his life, he was clearly the international spokesperson for spiritualism, and devoted a great deal of energy and money to the cause. We can understand the public's fascination with spiritualism if we think back a bit. First of all, this is a time, spiritualism itself said, this is not a religion, this is science. We can demonstrate to you that what we're telling you is true. That's different, of course, from other religions, which basically say, take it on faith. And their idea of demonstration perhaps fell somewhat short by today's scientific standards, but it was seances, it was ectoplasmic manifestations, contact with the dead. He believed it. He was convinced by the scientific demonstrations. Now, I think he made some wise literary choices in not having Sherlock Holmes go down that path. Holmes famously says, this agency stands flat-footed upon the ground. No ghosts need apply. Holmes was not a spiritualist.
Yeah.
He was in many ways the supreme rationalist, and spiritualism could not be demonstrated to him, to his satisfaction. And it doesn't appear at all in the stories.
Which I keep coming up with this question about whether or not, I mean, he... It seems like almost as if he used Sherlock Holmes as a way of challenging himself, challenging some of his own ideas.
Yes, his own ideas, saying things that perhaps he didn't want to say himself,
yeah,
but he wanted someone else to say under his control. I think that's a very interesting point of view. There's a terrific biography of Conan Doyle called Teller of Tales by Daniel Stashower, a good friend, and the book explores a great deal of Conan Doyle's spiritualism efforts and the interesting problems. For example, the relationship between Conan Doyle and Houdini, which is, I think, going to be covered in a couple of movies that are going to come out shortly, is very interesting. Both of them fascinated by spiritualism, fascinated by the idea of life after death, coming from very different points of view. Certainly part of Conan Doyle wanted to have that critical ability and skepticism of Houdini, but couldn't allow himself to do it.
I want to cram in two final questions. Let me just take from, we have a caller, Michael. We don't have time to get to the call, but he asks about Sherlock Holmes' brother.
Aha, uh-huh. Mycroft Holmes.
Yes.
Wonderfully played in the new films by Stephen Fry, who has a striking physical resemblance to the Mycroft of the Sidney Paget illustrations. Mycroft is 7 years older than Holmes. He only appears in three of the stories. Yet he's a fascinating figure. He is very antisocial. He belongs to the Diogenes Club, where no one speaks. He is, at times, the British government.
Yeah.
He's a critical player in one of the back rooms of the British government.
And let me ask you this finally. Do you think that people these days... Nowadays, it's like that woman I mentioned who had come to you and said,
yes.
"Gosh, I didn't know that that there were books." Do you worry that people aren't actually reading the books themselves, or do you hope that they can find them?
I do hope they'll find them,
yeah.
But they are, and I hear the wonderful news that as these terrific Robert Downey films succeed, the Sherlock Holmes stories are flying off booksellers' shelves. They are restocking. Sellers have told me that they have sold 10 times as many editions of the original stories as they had in the years before. Of course, the fact that some of those copies might be copies of my own books is nice too, but I'm so happy to see people turning back to the real stuff. And Robert Downey, by the way, is quick to say that, you know, they've tried hard to take from the stories because they're so wonderful. People should go back and read them.
Leslie Klinger, author of, among other books, The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes, most recently co-edited A Study in Sherlock Stories Inspired by the Holmes Canon. Leslie Klinger, thank you very much for the time.
What a pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.